Blog Talk Radio.
All right, you're listening to The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith. On today's show, we're going to talk to Chris Bodor, Chuck Gow, William Stewart Barney, and Lindsay Thomas. For tuning in. So everything's going pretty good over here. We got a couple callers on the line already. We'll talk about the guests that are going to be on tonight. We're going to have, on the Unknown Show, we're going to have Chris Bodor from Pulp Plant Press. He's the creator of the employee workbook, and he's going to come on and talk about that. Later on, we're going to talk to Chuck Howe. He's an author with an upcoming book of short stories called If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead. He'll come on and read. Later on, Lindsay Thomas will be calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to talk about her new novella from Cleftjaw, Blind Date at the Glass-Eyed Disco. And then later on, we'll also talk to Cleftjaw poet William Seward Bonney, a good friend of mine, and he has a collection out called Galaxy vs. Seder 2. So that's what's going on later. So to start the show, I want to talk about a couple things that are going on, different projects I am wrapping up over here. Right now, the First Time Anthology, which is an anthology about how a bunch of writers lost their virginity, that's pretty much wrapping up. I wound up doing a lot more drawings for it than I was planning on doing, a lot more my own artwork, which I haven't really done that kind of stuff for a long time, but kind of held the release date up a little bit, but I think the thing's looking great, and I'm excited to get that out soon, so look for that. Also, I wanted to mention, I'm reading submissions for Cleftjaw right now, so if anybody has any short stories, poems, you want to send over to Cleftjaw, it's just cleftjaw@gmail.com, cleftjaw@gmail.com. And I got to tell you a little warning, the style is left side of the brain stuff, raw stuff, wild writing. Check out the Cleftjaw website and look at some past issues to get an idea of what's going on with that. So last few days, we're lucky enough to see some of my friends from some presses that have been in New York City. My buddy Jonathan Penton was here from Unlikely Stories, and Mark Vincenz was here, Mad Hat, along with a lot of the other Mad Hat crew. And we're bouncing around, just going to a few different readings. And I want to shout out to those guys, Susan Lewis. I want to shout out to her, too. The Mad Hat crew really did a great job at these readings. And Jonathan Penton really killed it. If you guys see Jonathan reading in the area, anywhere near you, go check it out, because he's always worth your time. So the last thing I want to mention before we take on the first caller here is Tollbooth, my forthcoming novel from Piscataway House. Mark Bernetti and the guys that do the Idiom zine. That book is coming along pretty good. It's right now being formatted for Kindle. And print copies are on the way. There's a release party that's being set up as we speak. All right, here. So I got a few callers on the line. I'm going to take the first caller. We'll see who this is. Hello, who am I talking to?
Hey, Bud, it's Chuck.
Oh, Chuck, what's going on, man?
Nothing much. How are you?
I'm doing very, very good. I'm going to pull you on after our first guest, but I was just curious if you had been a caller with a question or a comment,
So just hang on the line, okay, Chuck?
Yep, I'll be here. All right.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, Paul, hey, are you there?
Yeah, this is Chris Bodor, man. What's happening?
Hey, how you doing, buddy? I
should
have got your number before the show.
Well, it's on the bathroom wall.
Yeah, I got so many. My whole bathroom is just littered with graffiti, you know? At least different people, man. So how you doing, all right?
I'm doing good, yeah. San Augustine weather was pretty brutal today, working out in the heat, but, you know, I haven't shoveled any snow yet down here, you know, so it's no surprise that it's going to be hot down in Florida, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not a Florida native, though. You live in Florida now.
No, we moved down 10 years ago. I was working in New York City for 10 years and started up the writing career and going to poetry readings. You ever hear of a place called Alt Doc Coffee way back when?
No, years ago.
Yeah.
I'm a dumb fuck, coupled with the fact that I'm only 30, so I don't know very much about the world at all.
Yeah, so that would have been because it was at least 10 years ago. So, but yeah, we had every other Thursday we would open up a microphone right on Avenue A, down that way, and we'd get people to come in. Sometimes we'd have the window open and people would come by and come in to read, but we did that for like 14 months, and my first like anthology or foray into self-publishing was to document that scene. So we got people to give us the poems that they had read, and I put them all together and made it ready to send off to a printer, and we sold copies at the coffee shop. So
for everybody that's listening, if you're not familiar, we're talking to Chris Bodor. And Chris, when you're talking about this self-publishing in the beginning, was it always Poet Plant Press, or is that something newer?
No. Well, with all honesty, I started off as Poet Noise, and there's like this band called Bastro that had this lyric that was referring to looking at noise, and I was like, I'm going to have it as Poet Noise. So, Poet Noise was my first imprint. And
uh-huh.
And then I went to get poetnoise.com registered, and like someone told me that they had it already, and I got so upset. I was like, I know the Bastro lyric, that this is taken from, and the guy didn't even want to entertain it. He just told me that he would not sell me the domain name. So, when I came down here to Florida, I started learning about working outside and planting and horticulture and all that. And so I sort of like from the ashes of Poet Noise came Poet Plant Press. So and Robert Plant is in there also. But that's what Poet Plant Press is all about, man.
And so you have the employee workbook. Can we talk a little bit about that?
It's employees only, and
sure.
It's referred to as the workbook, only because of the fact that the book before that is called My Time, the Lunch Break Book, and
sure.
It's actually part of a trilogy, because we also have a Heart Poor, the Love Book. So, those are three things that I'll put out that speak of a very specific theme, and now it's ready for the next project, which is pretty much putting my stuff together. And I had a book when I was in New York City. It was called Railroad Ties. It was about the train of thought commuter, because I was riding from 23rd Street where I worked all the way back to Beacon, New York, every day, round trip for 10 years. And so that's, I'd be writing poems on the train. So it was like, the train of thought commuter, and that's what Railroad Ties was all about. So, when I moved down here, it literally just got derailed. How can I write poems when I don't have a train to get on? So it took me a while to figure out, what my new voice was going to be, and, you know, I'm just, I like to do kind of like the everyman kind of thing, you know, stuff that
sure.
everyone can relate to. And so, you know, that's what it's all about.
You, do you think your style has changed a lot just because of your situation and your ability, how you're able to write? It's been a reflection of that, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what happened was, it's like when I was, I would walk every day from Grand Central to 23rd Street, and a lot of my poems were things that I would see, even from the train window, and, you know, that's
yeah.
where the whole idea of train of thought came from. You know, you're
sure.
looking out the window, you see something like a gargoyle on a building, and then your mind thinks about something, and then all of a sudden you do this little train of thought. But, you know, I was walking when one day I was walking at 23rd Street, and, you know, there's a headline on the newspaper that Kurt Cobain, the poet of a generation, is found dead. You know, so I write a poem about that and that stupid club, you know.
Yeah.
All these years later, I would probably write a totally different poem, you know,
uh-huh.
and because of my age and all that. But, you know, it's more stuff that is more mature, really. You know, it's
sure.
the stuff that, you know, we all deal with when we get to be 40-something, but, you know, not in the voice of some kid who used to be diving off stages at, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers shows way back when, before they, you know, had some credibility, you know, way back
yeah.
when. So, but
do you have any of these poems kicking around? Do you have any you could read? I'm curious to hear
yeah.
Some of these train of thought poems, and you can give an example of how you used to sound, and then maybe as a
oh,
juxtapose,
well,
you can read some newer stuff.
Well, this is the best way I can do that is. I put together a train of thought piece, but, you know, I performed it
sure.
a couple of months ago. And it was for a reading that was on the theme of wanderlust. So, you
yeah.
know, that really spoke to me because I used to write. So I took people who know my 2001 manuscript, they'll recognize some stuff in here. And then I also threw in some new stuff. So it's about 40 lines. You want me to bust it out now?
Yeah, read it, please.
Okay. It's called Train of Thought Travel, and it goes something like this. Destination sought, ticket bought, St. Christopher is riding by my side, traveling on this train of thought. Wanderlust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. I travel to town in secondhand clothes, garments embroidered with monograms of souls that I will never know. Lovers lock lips in the seat across. She gazes into his eyes. She is tasting his every word. But courtships do not last forever. Train window resembles a television screen, broadcasting one ever-changing channel. Garbage, gargoyle, street signs, street walkers, burning cars, prison walls. Through this window I see it all. Ascend, ascend, get ready for the end. A college kid with dreadlocks is playing a six string. Seven train seats in front of me. Voice and guitar rise above the chug-chug of cold steel wheels. He's singing a Jimi Hendrix tune. He knows Black Bird. He knows Black Dog. Have you ever been experienced?
That's pretty bad. It's like how you snuck into Led Zeppelin in there, like you were saying, Robert Plant, huh?
Yeah. I got the cool thing about Poet Plant Press is it's out of my garage, and
uh-huh.
you know, so that I've got it. You know, I never ever played in a band when I grew up. People
uh-huh.
always say to me, "What instrument do you play? You're such a big music fan." I said, "The only instrument I play is the radio." And the reality is I got every Led Zeppelin album in one of those,
uh-huh.
like, frames, like an album frame, displayed in my little garage above the garage door mechanism to make the garage door open and all that. So, you know, it's cool.
I like
I kind of could understand why Led Zeppelin would be such an appeal to so many people. But like when I think about like the poetry, the poets, because like Led Zeppelin catches some flack really for being like just like a ripoff. You know, when they came out, they were just completely like ripping off so many songs, just Chicago blues and just jacking all this stuff. But I mean, to me, that's what poetry is, you know? You steal a little from here, you steal a little from there, you make it your own. And I kind of really think that you have that, they have that reference in there. Cool.
Yeah, good. You know, a lot of bands were influenced by Zeppelin, just like Zeppelin wasn't, you know, they got influenced by a lot of bands. But the brilliance of Zeppelin was in the marketing. Peter Grant was definitely a fifth member of the band, and they really were right place, right time type of thing. And, you know, it was before the age of videos, and, you know, it was always like sold out concerts, but, you know, they made it into a real event. And they'll never be anything like it. But when I rate a band, I always do it note for note. So if I'm gonna, you know, I put it on, I listen to it, and if it takes me to another place, then that's you know what it's all about. It doesn't matter what kind of trousers Robert Plant has on at that time, or you know how big his midsection is. It's you know really about note for note and the quality of the music. And you know, if it does something for you, then who has a right to argue with you? You know, it's what it is to you, you know?
Cool. So, your new stuff, projects you're working on now, new poetry you're writing. Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing now. Your new pursuits.
What I've done is, like, when I look at Railroad Ties all the way back from 2001, you know, I was riding on the train, but it was distilled from 3 years of daily writing. So not just this past January, but the January before, someone actually read my work, and they're like, you got to do some new stuff. You know, 2001 was a long time ago. You need to have a second book, and it's almost like the audience needs it type of thing. So I took that as an invocation to just get off my, get off my ass and start, you know, putting words to, instead of just talking about it, let's do some writing. So I brought my poems to that person every time I wrote a poem, pretty much thanking them for the inspiration and then also getting their feedback. They're an English teacher way back when, so, you know, it really is meaningful to hear what they have to say. So, you know, I'm a year and a half in to that 3 year journey of daily writing. So my plan is a year and a half from now to look at the last, you know, 3 years of work and distill it down to my next manuscript, and that'll be, you know, Railroad Ties was the 20-something. Married kid with two young children, and this will be the 40-something kids are off at college type of voice, you know? And
you seem like you get a big kick out of publishing other people's stuff. I seem to pick that up from you. Talk a little bit about that. What do you get from running your own press, and what do you get from helping other people put their work out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it all came about, like, before I hit the home run with Railroad Ties, I had put out a manuscript of my stuff. So it was right when we were doing the open mic down at Alt Doc Coffee, and I had this manuscript and an opportunity to host an open mic, so I would read all my stuff, and then I, that's where my first book on poet noise was Train of Thought, and it didn't sell. You know, I couldn't move any copies of it. You know, people would look at it and say, $10 is what I wanted, so that I could, you know, put out future projects. See, the what I was told with self-publishing is you just try to make enough to act as seed money for your next print run. So it's very humble intentions to, like, if it costs you $5 per book to do 150 copies, then, you know, if and you sell one for $10, that means you now have two, you know, books. And, you know, one you can give to a press person for free or what have you. But, you know, these copies weren't really moving, so I decided to get other people involved. And then when I got other people involved in an anthology project, they said, well, I'll have 10. I'd love 10 copies. You know, it's, you know, oh, I'd love 5 copies. And then all of a sudden, I would do a print run of 150, and all the copies would be spoken for except for maybe 20. And, you know, there's enough of a break even that I could give those to press people. They would write about the anthology, and then all of a sudden I had the seed money for the next anthology. So, you know, that's why I really held off on my own stuff, because things seem to be moving forward by helping other people. And,
sure.
I mean, let's be realistic. People helped me way back when. You know, it's only fair that I should give back at this point, you know.
Yeah, I mean, plus I mean, there really is something fun about putting together an anthology. You know, aside from everything else, it's just a, I don't know. It's just there's something really cool about it. I'm like, I'm kind of deep into doing one now, and I'm just, I'm getting a lot of joy out of it. You know, I really am.
Yeah. Do you know Tim Hall? He was involved with. My mind's drawing a blank. He just moved back into New York, but way back when he was involved with the New York Hangover, when an early anthology, I did this one anthology called Poet Noise 2000. You know, so and it was a very simple concept. Anyone, all the way back in the year 2000, email was new, but anyone who emailed me a poem from all over the world, I'd consider it for the anthology. So it was a pretty broad-based concept. And, you know, Tim wrote this amazing letter after he received his 10 copies, and it's all about, you know, an open letter to Chris Bodor type of thing. And he's like, you know, anthologies by nature are fickle beasts. We always search for our poem and then leave the other ones aside. And he said in his letter, I read it from cover to cover at the local tavern, and, you know, and he goes, my only question to you, Chris, is how did you do it? You know, how did you make this very readable anthology when so many anthologies out there are just self-serving and they only please the person whose poem is in the book, you know? So I got that praise very early on. So every anthology I put out, I'd like it to at least be something that, you know, the person would read from cover to cover. And the employees only is kick ass. I mean, we got so many talented people in there, and just to have Mike Watt from the Minutemen, you know, I didn't know he was a poet, and he has this, you know, poetry side to him. So, you know, his poem is in there about a lighthouse keeper. And R.D. Armstrong, who does Lummox Press, he's got a piece in there. And then, you know, I just found out that I'm going to have a new piece in Lummox, too. R.D.'s putting out this real thick, like 200-page book in the fall. And so I got a piece in there. But what did you think of Employees Only? I mean,
well, I really liked it. Actually, I wanted to read a couple things from it. People listening, and I hope it kind of, you know, just the work speaks for itself. I'm gonna read. I picked a couple poems here I want to read for everybody. The first one really stood out for me was Alethea Dremmer. She has a poem in the Employees Only workbook, and it's called Saints in Waiting. There's an editor's note. This poem was written at work in the emergency room. Leafy is an emergency room ER nurse. Words about real people that the author took care of and thus are part of her work. Okay. So here goes. This is called Saints in Waiting. An old man hovers in the waiting area at midnight with his small blue eyes muddied from years of alcohol and smoke. I ask him if I can help him, and he opens his mouth, teeth rotting, breath laced with drink, telling me he needs to talk. He starts with his worries. No one loves me. Nervously touching his face, sickness in his family, wrongs and rights committed unto others, love and sadness, old war times, and how the wife tells him to shut up, you bastard. Loving words spoke from him about his dead father, a man always on the straight and narrow, a man who spoke line after line from the Bible in stern tone. He speaks of his two sisters, both smart and good-looking, accomplished teachers and nurses, his insignificance apparent of their distance within geographical closeness. Plastic covers flipped, plastic cupboard pictures flipped, neat faces of children and grandchildren he never sees or holds, run by animated. He tells me of the time his son hugged him for no reason, tears welling in his eyes, rims red and moist as he carefully touches them away. Can't waste what little I have. I stand there with shades of indifference, thinking of stories about old beggars at the roadside whom no one will help, will work for food. Prophets, deities, monks, saints in waiting, testing the fiber of humanity, testing the soul's moral fortitude as I lay my hand on his arm. So that one really stood out for me. Alicia is a
cool,
great poet. And she runs a really good couple really good websites right now. And I was really happy when I opened this book up and I saw that she was in there, so love that poem.
Yeah.
And then you pointed it out too, the next poem right here, right after that, The Lighthouse Keeper, Mike Watt.
Mm.
So people should check it out. They really should check this book out.
Yeah.
I hope they do.
Yeah. Hey, one super cool thing is, of course it's available on Amazon. You could just, find it real easy.
Uh-huh.
But, there's 5 copies of it over at a Powell's bookstore out in Portland. Kevin
yeah.
Sample, I've published Kevin, and Kevin's got his own press, and he works at Powell's. And, I just love the idea of, this 40-something guy from St. Augustine, Florida has, that beautiful anthology in a bookstore in Portland. So, there's sure you can get it on Amazon, but, for all those West Coast people who are listening, definitely go to the bookstore and, check it out.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing. It gets harder to support bookstores. I know I had a local one, and I live in New York City, and now they keep disappearing,
Yeah.
But it's always worth the trip. So I want to read one more from this book for everybody listening.
That'd be awesome.
And,
yeah.
And then I'd like if you have anything else you'd like to read of your own after. This poem is called
sure.
Shift Change. This is by R.D. Armstrong.
Awesome.
All right. Having spent 30 years plying the handyman trade, I suddenly find myself facing a forced retirement, brought on by a life of bad decisions, a genetic time bomb, and my stubborn independence. While the scrap heap beacons, I foolishly cling to my denials. Reality creeps in like a cold fog, and the smell of decomp places roses. Here's me, waiting for them to call my name one last time. So yeah, great poem. Another
yeah.
great writer.
Short and sweet.
Yeah. So can I pry some more poems out of you? Anything else you'd like to read?
Yeah, I just printed out some stuff from, the manuscript. The interesting thing is I put a date on each poem just to kind of like
uh-huh.
document that first like kernel, that first little nugget of creativity, and I'm looking for some stuff from this year. One of the early poems I hammered out when I first you know, started working on the second manuscript kind of like sets the tone. It's, you know, 2012, when we got into 2012, it was kind of like the end of the world year because everyone was talking about the Mayan calendar and that, you know, on you know, in December of 2012 is when the Mayan calendar ended. So it was kind of bizarre to start off a new year with it possibly ending, you know. So
yeah.
a lot of my writing, you know, deals with that, you know, concept of if today was the last day of your life, would you be ready to meet your maker? And sometimes I say, if you give me two more weeks, I'll be ready, you know, or if you give me a month, I'll be just about ready. And, you know, that's not the way it's going to be, you know. So to set the tone, I got this poem called Ascend. It go, you know, it's a short one, but you ready for it?
Sure, man.
Okay. A funny thing happened to me on the way to the afterlife. I stopped fighting and became friends with my daughters and my wife. Ascend, ascend, get ready for the end. On my last days on earth, what would I wear? Clean underwear and a smile. Ascend, ascend, get ready for the end. First kiss, apocalypse. We do not choose our daughter's tattoos. Ascend, ascend, get ready for the end. You know, a lot of these pieces are written with live performance in mind. That's one of the realities of you know, my writing is I've been doing a monthly open mic on the last Sunday of every month here in St. Augustine. This coming reading in August on the 25th, that's marking the 4-year anniversary. So, you know, back in August of 2009, we turned on a microphone and we went to a coffee shop, then another coffee shop, then a bookstore, like a gift shop, and now we're at a place that serves food, like a restaurant, but it's got original artwork on the wall. So, you know, in those 4 years and the four different places, I could only get by so long reading stuff from a 2001 manuscript. You know, train of thought could only go so far. So,
sure.
You know, I really, you know, it's kind of exciting to be back into this creative mode instead of just being the spokesperson, the facilitator, the come on everyone, sign up and join the open mic, or publishing
sure.
all these people and putting out the anthologies. It's the real deal, you know. I got stuff that... you know, we'll stand the test of time, or, you know, it's...
Great.
Yeah, cool.
Can I get you to read one more?
Yes. This one is Heartbreaker. It's what happens when we get the empty nest syndrome. So, not syndrome, but reality. I mean, I got two girls in college now, and, you know, it goes something like this. I wrote it back in August when she was heading out to the University of Florida to run away from the home. But I you know, she's an awesome girl, and you know, I just you know, it goes something like this. 2 decades later, Florida Gator, a parent's job is complete. The house will be quiet without the sounds of our 2 children's feet. Time to go away. Please, please stay. Leave the nest to do your best. High school has become a faded memory. College town invaded. 2 sisters reunited. Mother wants her babies back. During our week of million goodbyes, you ask me, how am I? And for all that you will achieve, how could a father grieve? However, in a few unfamiliar days from now, in this unfamiliar reality of tomorrow, I choke back tears of sorrow. Go away. Please stay. That's it.
That's a good thought, you know. You sending your kids off. That's got to be hard, you know. Has to be a very hard thing. But I want to thank you for coming on and reading all of this great stuff and talking about the employees only workbook. And I'm looking forward to your next release when you get done with it.
Thanks. I love that show you did a while back with Frank Reardon. Did that ring a bell? Yeah. And Frank was talking about the reality that there's a poetry reading in every city on any day, and when you go on vacation or travel, you know, you can always meet up with people and so forth. So, you know, I'll be flying into LaGuardia Saturday morning, and I'll be around for, you know, 9 days between New York City and Connecticut. So, you know, I look forward to breaking bread with you, or at least hanging out with you at a poetry reading. Yeah, cool, man.
Definitely. I found one Monday nights. I know you're asking me to see. Thing is, you know, it's funny you become a stranger in your own city, you know. I just had a couple guests come in. Cool. Unlikely Stories, Jonathan Penton and the Mad Hat Press guys were just here. And there's a Monday night reading every Monday night at Revival Bar. And it's cool. We just saw last night. You'll have to try to check that out.
I'll think about it. And Puma Pearl is an employees only. She has a piece in there. And she's a huge New York City spoken word artist. And you know, I had the pleasure of doing a... getting on the open mic list with her 2 years ago, last time I was in town. So, you know, it's bittersweet. I worked on 23rd Street for 10 years, and that was actually 10 years ago, so it's ancient history. And, I just love coming back and, you know, checking in with people, but also making new friends as well, too. So thanks for having me on your show, bud. It's a pleasure.
Hey, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I'll catch you when you come into New York, all right?
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Be good, man.
Yep. Bye.
All right. So thanks again to Chris Brodeur. And next on the show, we're going to talk to Chuck Howe. Chuck's a writer from Westchester, New York. It's about a half hour north of the city. And he's been a friend of mine on the internet for way too long and in person the last couple of years. And Chuck's got a new book of stories coming out called If I Had Wings, These Windmills Would Be Dead. And Chuck, are you there?
I am here. How you doing?
How you doing? How you doing, all right?
I'm doing great, yeah.
Good, yeah. It's a nice day today, man. Nice day here in the city, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's beautiful out. I made sure to go out, get all my stuff done, and be here to talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for coming back on the show. I'm sitting by an open window right now. I'm looking out on my street. Everybody's riding their bikes down there. Nice. What are you you're calling from Westchester?
I'm locked inside so that I don't have any noises bothering me or anything like that.
I want to get you to talk a little bit about your book of short stories is coming out. I've read bits and pieces of it here and there, and it's always real entertaining. Really cool shit. Can you explain what's going on with the book?
Yeah, definitely. It's actually all pretty much creative nonfiction. And it's all stories I've been working on for the past few years and started out just writing them for fun and posting them on Facebook. People enjoyed them. So then I figured, well, maybe I should edit them and make them actually
that's always
readable.
It's always a funny turning point, isn't it? You know, they all stick to all this, you know.
Yeah.
So you start editing the stories. What happens next?
Well, you know, then I started putting them together and realizing that all these small fragmented stories that I had written kind of come together and give a complete story.
Yeah.
So, you know, I figured a couple other stories that I would have to write here and there. But it's funny because as I'm sitting here thinking about it, getting ready to read one of the stories, I'm realizing that it all kind of started with Uno Kudo. And
Chuck's
Chuck Schaffer and Uno Kudo is a it's like an art meets literary book. It was an Amazon book, the first two volumes, and it's really great writing paired up with really, really, really great artwork. And Chuck had a piece in the first and second Uno Kudo. So go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem at all. And before the first one came out, it was mostly just people who had been reading each other's stuff and looking at each other's art online. And for the most part, before that, I'd always written fiction, and if it was nonfiction, it was extremely thinly veiled in a fiction. But, you know, I never tried to write anything nonfiction. And
yeah.
When the deadline was kind of approaching for Uno Kudo, it just happened to be that I had been somewhere I hadn't been in 20 years, and it brought back memories, and the story just came out. And the way it worked out, it was the first story I wrote for the book. It's going to be kind of in the middle of the book. But it is a real turning point in the stories. It's kind of going from the happy-go-lucky childhood, you know, semi-rebellious teen years into real life, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the one story that that kicks off the second half of the book, I think.
That's great. And what's the story called?
Okay, this story is called Yellow Barn, and it is the story that was in the first Uno Kudo, and it will be in my book. If I had wings, these windmills would be dead. So here it is, Yellow Barn. I walked into the type of bar you only went to if you were depressed or under 21. The bouncers at all the other bars knew your brother, and you had his ID. On the day Kelly told me she had a new boyfriend, I was both. We were still very much in love when I left for school. We had agreed to see other people. The reality didn't hit until she actually found someone. She was still in high school. I was in college. I was supposed to find someone first. The bar seemed dark and empty when I first walked in. There were two old fucks crying in their beer. They would be perfect company. The place had darts, a game on the TV, a jar of pickled hard-boiled eggs, and that was it. But I glanced down to the end of the bar and was immediately caught up in Michelle's giant brown eyes instead. They were staring a hole right through me. I froze. She turned on her bar stool, still looking right into my eyes, and pulled the stool next to her out, the most inviting move a woman has ever made towards me. A few hours later, it was either love or the inability to stand up straight that saw us walking home, arms wrapped around each other. Everything about this girl was perfect. It was the fall of 1991, and all the kids were just starting to get into grunge music. She liked the Dead. She was a Canadian, and she liked hockey. She had a beautiful laugh, and best of all, she was into me. Everything screamed out for me to kiss her as we got to the dorm. As I moved in, she turned her head, and I got nothing but cheek. I want to, but not yet. Call me tomorrow. Somehow, even with no real goodnight kiss, I floated back to the dorm. Over the next few weeks, we spent almost every free minute with each other. She had friends in Ithaca, which wasn't too far, so we went there almost every weekend. On one trip back, we pulled over at a yellow barn. We were in the middle of nowhere, and chances are no other cars would pass all night. So we decided to investigate the creepy old place. A rusted hinge that held a padlock had already been ripped from the wood and dangled from the door. As we went inside, we heard animals scurrying away. A big hole in the roof let in the moon, giving it the perfect mood lighting. I thought this would be it. She still hadn't even let me give her a real kiss. It had only been a short time, but we were in college. Shouldn't we have jumped into bed right away? We lay down under the hole in the roof to watch the stars in each other's arms. I tried to make a few moves, but was politely blocked each time. I got the idea and just lay there with her. By the time we got up, the sun was shining and we had told each other almost every story we had. We got back to the car, and I was feeling great, like I had made a real connection. A week later, on that same stretch of road, she seemed very distant. As we approached the yellow barn, I pulled over. She looked at me a bit confused. I motioned for us to just go in, and she shook her head, a small tear coming out of her large brown eye. Come on, I said. You can tell me. Inside. I couldn't imagine what was wrong. Things seemed to be going so well, right up until we left for Ithaca that Friday. She slowly got out of the car and made her way to the barn. We just lay there in the quiet for what seemed like an eternity. The moon wasn't as full, so it was darker inside. Clouds covered Clouds covered the sky exposed by the hole. She lifted her head on her elbow and looked right at me. There was a deep sadness in her eyes. For a second, I thought she was going to kiss me. I went to the bar that night to get drunk and forget all about love. And then you walked in the door. I started to speak, but she stopped me. Just let me get through this. Scott had called that day. She told me all about him. He was a lazy asshole from what I could gather. He had told me that he had been a junkie for the last year. I never knew. He found out last month that he's HIV positive. My heart stopped beating. AIDS. It had only been around a few years, but still so little was known about it, especially by an 18-year-old kid. I was tested 2 weeks ago, she told me. She buried her face deep in my chest, and I could feel her body shaking with the spasms of tears. I just looked up at the blank hole in the ceiling. I tried to think of something to say, but nothing came, so I just held her tight. I was afraid I might break a bone, hers or mine. She made strange noises as she muffled her cries in my body. Her face looked completely lost inside of me. I looked down at her in the dark and tried to stop myself, but a single laugh escaped. Her head immediately jerked up. Her large, beautiful, brown, bloodshot eyes looked at me through tears. She was confused. She tried to say something, but the words wouldn't come. I'm sorry. For a second there, you look like a lioness feeding on my ripped open heart, I said. Her look of confusion turned into a small smile. She gave me a quick eye roll, and the smile faded, but it was the most beautiful smile I'd ever seen. She put her head down and went back to feeding without another word until the black hole in the ceiling began to turn gray. And that's Yellow Barn.
That's really something else, man. It's really something to write about, you know, to be able to write about your own life with that kind of objectivity, you know.
Yeah, and actually, I don't think I've ever read that out loud before, so that was a little rougher than I thought it would be, but there you go. Got through it.
Yeah, no, that was awesome. I really appreciate you you taking the time, you know, to read that for us. It was pretty cool. It was really cool. I love that. I've read that quite a few times in the first Nuno Kudo, you know. I like that story a lot. So,
yeah, it was such a departure from what I normally wrote that it kind of just sparked this whole new writing burst in me. So
that's good. Yeah, it's
a lot to think for.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about when that heavy wave of creativity comes. You know, you gotta ride it while you can.
Oh yeah, definitely.
So you have another story you're gonna read?
Yeah, I figured, well, since I read that one, there are only actually two stories about Michelle in the book, and that was the first one. And the last one, it's a very, very short story, but
okay.
It's right near the end of the book. I figured I should read this one, too. And this one is called At Least I'm Enjoying the Ride. I had only been to her grave twice. The last time was on the day of her funeral. The first time was about a month before she died. She looked weak and grimaced in pain when she moved, but like always, Michelle was in a great mood. She knew that she didn't have very long left. She actually didn't want me coming out and seeing her like that, but I know she was glad to see me once I got there. The calls had been getting less frequent, and I hadn't seen her in a couple of years, but when she called and she didn't think she had much longer, I came running. It was a strange visit to the cemetery. I was in shock, looking at the grave of a friend. I stared at the ground, knowing she would soon be underneath the grass. Michelle was looking at the mountains and the trees and the beautiful, peaceful view all around the cemetery. I couldn't see any of that. I could only see a small patch of land that would one day swallow her. I was feeling very guilty about not visiting more often. I kept trying to speak, but no words came out, and finally she broke the silence. "Isn't it beautiful?" she asked, using too much energy as she swirled her thin frame around, barely managing to get her skirt to twirl. She steadied herself on her cane as she came to a stop. I put my arm around her to help support her. There was almost nothing there. When I met her, she had the physique of a true outdoor sports lover. She was thin, but a very muscular thin. Now she was an emaciated thin. "Yes, it's a great view." All I could think of was that she wouldn't be able to see it from under the dirt and grass. "Just save your energy, okay?" "Save it for what?" "I have been saving it. Saving it so I could dance." She did a little spin in towards me and grabbed my free hand. "Dance with me?" "I'm not going to dance on your grave," I replied with a laugh. "Oh, you just take all the fun out of dying," she said with a smile. "But it isn't my grave yet, just a good place to dance." She began gently swaying in my arms, and I couldn't resist. I could never argue with her logic. So soon enough, I was dancing on a beautiful piece of grass with Michelle and an amazing view. And that one is, at least I'm enjoying the ride.
Huh. That's really something else too, man. It's it's a real pleasure having you read these stories, you know. But
Well,
so what's going on with the book? Talk about it's pretty cool because you're putting it together mostly on your own, but you got some really good help. I know Aaron McParland, Nuno Kudo, art director, is helping you with the layout, right?
First of all, she did an amazingly beautiful cover for me, and I couldn't be happier with it. And actually, much like what you're saying with what happened with the first time book, is now as she's going through and doing the layout, she's saying, "Ooh, I kind of want to do some sketches here and there."
Uh-huh.
So I was kind of hoping to have it out at the end of the month. At this point, I figure some point in the fall, because if she wants to do sketches, I'm going to let her. She's amazing. And
yeah, she's great.
Whatever she does will only help. So
I got to commend you, because I think something happens with self-publishing. There's this stigma because people do it wrong. They rush it. They don't finish things correctly. They don't take the time to even. I mean, you know, sometimes you pick up a self-published book, it's not even spell-checked, you know. But I know that. you're really pulling out all the stops here, because you're putting this out on your own, which is perfectly cool. I love that, man. I think it's the greatest thing anybody can ever do. Just, you know, take the bull by the horns and do it themselves. You actually you've gone out of your way and had this thing professionally proofread and edited, and professionally laid out and all that stuff, right?
You know what? I'm lucky enough to have just amazingly talented friends, and when I can help them or they can help me, it's never even a question. And the editing, that's my weakest point. People who have read some of the stories I've posted, when a lot of the earlier stories in the book, I would post them as soon as I wrote them without even reading them again, you know. So
there's something really cool about that too, though.
Yeah, you know, and that was fun. It was a great exercise, and it produced a lot of very, very good stories for me, so I can't complain. But then it really needed editing. It needed editing I knew I couldn't do, and I'm so lucky to have a friend of mine whose mother, Emily Rappaport, is one of those editors where she... Even days after she finished reading it and didn't even have it in front of her, she was calling me saying, "Oh no, Bennett Cerf's name is spelled wrong," you know, things like that. And it was just amazing, and it was an eye opening experience working with editors like that. So.
You learned a lot, didn't you, about how to edit from that, didn't you?
Oh sure, and I mean I've helped other people with things before, but this is a you can tell the difference between just somebody looking over it and a professional editor.
Yeah, I think I'd recommend for everybody whether or not they, it's one thing, you know, if you're writing for enjoyment, but if you don't have the means to go off and take writing classes, you know, you're like me. I'm not any good with. I was never any good with editing until I actually got in touch with pro editors and had them edit up things that I wrote, and then I can look and see how they did it, and they give you the marked up document. You can look at it and you go, oh fuck, that's how you, that's the correct way to do dialogue, and you know, all these things.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at like, wow, the story changes tense three times. You know, it goes from first person, you know, present, and
yeah,
then switches to past and things like that that you don't know to look for. But if you have, if you take the time to just have somebody show you who's, you know, even if you have to. I would recommend people, if you don't know somebody who's a pro editor, spend the money, a couple
yeah.
hundred dollars, have your manuscript looked over, learn from it. You know, it's a great opportunity to really improve your writing if you're not really sure that you're up for the whole challenge of it, you know. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, and I know. I mean, I just, even now, I think I'm going to have it probably looked over one more time, but I feel so
yeah.
much better in, you know, having it published now than I did before she looked through it.
I mean,
and not only that, she gave me a lot of opinion about stories and stuff and helped me feel good about the direction that I went with everything. So, you know, that always helps
yeah.
too.
There's something else. There's something that happens with editing for grammar, editing for content, two different things, you know?
Yeah.
It's really cool
yeah.
how you know, some people, they might suck at grammar, but they'll really help you with artistic direction or whatever. That's all for fun, though, right?
Yeah. And before, I know you've got other people that got to come on too, but before you go, I just want to send out a shout out to my friend Jessica, who's down in Nashville. I know you're friends
yeah.
with her too.
Yeah,
she's putting up an incredible fight, and we love you, Jess. If you're listening to this, we're always thinking of you.
Yeah, she's a hell of a person. She's down there, you know, fighting her battle down there, and you know, I wish her luck too, man. It's a hell of a thing to go through, you know.
Yeah, just one of those people that just lightens up the world. So you gotta help them fight for and pull through. So.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure I got that out before I got off here.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to call in and read. I hope everybody looks out for your book. Look forward to this fall.
Me too.
I'll be sharing the links to it when it comes out. And it's called One More Time, If I Could Fly. If I Had
if
Wings,
I had
Wings, would be dead.
Right.
One more time. Say the title one more time.
If I had wings, these windmills would be dead.
There you go. All right,
there
Chuck,
you go.
Thank
and
you
thank you for all your help and for giving me the time here.
Oh, always. Anytime, man. All right. Catch you later, Chuck.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. We're going to take a short break here. And when I come back, I'm going to read some of the new Somnambulist zine, Martha Grover's zine out of Portland, Oregon. Speaking of Portland, Oregon. So stay tuned.
Danger of me losing all of my habits.
All right. I'm back. Sorry about that. That was Brendan Kastner, a friend of mine from New Jersey, and the song is called, it's a cover, the song is called Cupid, and he records as Bootsy Spankin's P.I. So in the mail yesterday, I got the new Somnambulist zine from Martha Grover. Martha's a great writer. I'm a fan of her work. She has a really great book out called One More for the People, and it's pretty much a collection of, I believe, 8 years of creative nonfiction, similar to what Chuck writes, creative nonfiction, gathered from her zine. And I'm just gonna read some of this thing because it's always awesome. And I don't know. Just gonna read something blind here. this story's called The Sloth and the Ghost. The summer I turned 9, the summer all 5 of us girls shared the master bedroom, the summer I saw the ghost, I did the report on the prehistoric sloth for homeschool. Mom had told us that we wouldn't be let out to summer break until we had completed our animal reports. They were to be our final project. So I got out some old National Geographics and started thumbing through them. In an article about the Amazon rainforest, I saw a strange animal held by a man in a khaki shirt. It had grayish hair like an old man's and long arms. Its hair had stuff growing on it, like moss and algae, giving it a gray and bright green color. I liked it. It was childlike, also ugly, slow, like an elderly Muppet. I went over to our tall green bookcase and pulled out the S volume of our orange set of encyclopedias and discovered the giant prehistoric sloth below the regular sloth entry. It seemed to me like a magical creature. The prehistoric ground sloth was huge, over 10 feet tall in some cases, and its disproportionate front claws looked like fearsome clubs. Secondly, it somehow supported its giant body with a weird knuckle-dragging gait. It was an otherworldly creature. The giant ground sloth existed in another realm, not our current reality, and so I was attracted to it. How I understood this realm at the time, now that as an adult I think about it, may have just been a vague pre-Noah's Flood type notion. In our family's version of Christianity, there was no prehistory. Everything that ever happened had been written down. That time, when giant sloths, or even dinosaurs roam the earth, was murky in my mind, chronologically speaking. I was confused because my mother had been teaching us that evolution was false and that the world was only 5,000 years old. We even had a timeline of world history on our playhouse wall that was supposed to explain everything. It had a little key with the races of the man on it at the bottom corner. Okay, I thought to myself. Mesthethuah lived 900 years and was the grandfather to Noah, and perhaps, just like the sloth, we humans were diminished, somehow after the flood, after the time of longevity. We woke up one day and everything was normal. The world was less magical. People only lived for 80 or 90 years. Therefore, the secular world, as my mom called it, exists as a temptation from Satan, father of lies. Way back in history, in the time before the flood, there must have been a time when magic, like miracles, magic's most pure older sister, existed side by side. You see, I was about to turn 9, and other, more scientific information was already beginning to seep into my brain like poisonous floodwaters. My mother didn't even try that hard, actually, to prevent this. Even though we were homeschooled, we still had access to public television, an old National Geographic and encyclopedia sets. I tried to reconcile the two timelines in my head. Dinosaurs, proto-humans. They all had to be explained in the biblical timeline because I'd never heard Mom say things didn't exist. It was just the timeline that needed adjusting. For example, dragons were actually dinosaurs, said a creationist video my mother had us watch. They, the creationists, routinely collapsed millions of earthly life into a few thousand. And why wasn't this possible? In a world where Jesus rose from the dead and Lot's wife had turned into a pillar of salt, anything was possible. Or a ghost.
What was a ghost? A dead person roamed the earth. Mom didn't believe in them. When you died, you went to heaven or hell, not to someone's attic. There was a lot of magic she didn't believe in, and strangely, as she denied their existence, she tried to protect us from this magic, from witches, ghosts, and fortune tellers and Ouija boards. We celebrate Halloween, but our church called it the family Harvest Festival, and there weren't any occult figures at the celebration. But Mom also believed in demons and angels. She believed in the supernatural, not what she classified superstition. There was magic, and then there were miracles, and there was a supernatural, and there was superstition, and where the line was drawn was my mission to find out. The ghost I saw stood outside our bedroom window. It was late twilight. I was on my way to use the bathroom in the master bedroom. I saw it in passing, glancing up. He stood under the bright floodlight that came on when the sun went down. The light came down white. In a cloud of parabolizing night moths and mosquitoes, his long grayish hair turned to black as it fell below his shoulders. His beard was similarly long and gray. He had sad eyes. He was wearing a robe. I looked up another time and he had vanished. Had I imagined him? Was this a ghost or a demon or an angel? Was it, as neurologist Oliver Sacks calls, the migraine-induced hallucination, a result of self-organizing activity in vast population visual neurons? Here's another one. This one's called Drakes and Dinos. My Uncle Eric was a chemical physicist and worked for NASA Aerojet during the 80s making rocket propellant. When I was a child, he came to visit us in Corvette about once a year. He was the only child I remembered ever contradicting my mother over the falsity of evolution. One visit, he sat in the living room of our mobile home in Corvette, his bald pate gleaming, tired and sweaty from his hike up Multnomah Falls with my father and watching a video my mom had brought at a creationist conference. Couldn't dragons have been dinosaurs, the film asked. Medieval and Chinese images of dragons flashed on the screen. I sat on the briskly gray couch behind Eric and watched the video. I could see the uncanny resemblance between the dragons and dinosaurs, huge lizards indeed. The dragon in the film exhaled smoke out of its nose and belched flame. If the world is only 5,000 years old, there's no room for the prehistoric. Couldn't the mythological thunderbird of the American plains have been the pterodactyl, the video asked? A winged shadow sped over desert sand, lightning forked through the sky over a mountain range. If there's no evolution, then all things must exist at once. There is no ancient, only recent. My father just laughed after the video was over. Well, I don't know about that one, Franny. Truth is always true. It doesn't choose the instances in which to reveal itself. Truth remains true through the ages and doesn't change. It's like the law of gravity, constant and reliable. And here's another one I'm going to read. This one's called Time Capsule. As a child, my Catholic cousin once suggested to me that the 7 days that it took God to create Earth and all of the life on it might actually have been longer. He was compromising between the literal fundamentalism that I took for granted and its more liberal Catholic school indoctrination. He was suggesting that these days were actually representative of longer periods. A Genesis day was not equivalent to a 20th century day. He was suggesting that you could do that, stretch time out or condense it. That you could write one thing and mean another. That you could create a whole world of your own, a fitting world that fit your liking. I did go to see Billy Graham's Children's Crusade once when I was about 11. It was a humid day in late spring. Reverend Graham was just a tiny dot at the bottom of the Coliseum. The air was gray and moist. Everything was sweating and had a slight sheen to their face. I remember very little of the sermon, but I was always been susceptible to altar calls. So at the end of the sermon, when he urged us repeatedly to come and give your lives to Jesus, lay down your sins at the altar, come down, don't be afraid to turn your back on sin, come on down, accept the love of Jesus, who knows and accepts you, come closer to Jesus, he loves you. Come to Jesus, his love is greater than you could possibly imagine, so come on down now, accept God in your life, come on down. The words blended together in a succession of beats and a come, come, come. I got up almost against my will, and I walked down the 20 flights of concrete steps to the crowded floor of the Colosseum. Volunteers waited, ready to escort repentant children into a walk with Jesus. The man that prayed with me read from a red paper script he held in his hand. He was about 45, a little fat and bold. He wore a gray T-shirt. And he asked me, "Do you ask Christ to be your personal Savior?" "Yes," I said. "Do you turn your back on sin?" "Yes," I nodded. My lower lip crumpled up, and I started crying. He awkwardly put his hand on my shoulder. I didn't know why I was crying. I felt nothing. I was crying because I felt nothing. I saw nothing. No great vision. No overwhelming sense of love and acceptance. Only the absence of a closeness that apparently everyone else felt. So that's some writing from Martha's New Zine. I hope everybody checks it out. I know I'm always a fan. I'm always a fan of her stuff. And I want to plug it real quick here. She sends these things out in the mail, which is pretty awesome, because how much snail mail do you get anymore? You ought to subscribe to Martha Zine. You can email her at MarthaGrover@hotmail.com. It's spelled as it sounds, MarthaGrover@hotmail.com. And a $15 subscription will get you, I believe, 4 zines, and they're usually pretty long. It's the one I'm looking at right now, it's probably got about, I want to say it's got about maybe 10 or 12 stories in it, and you get one every couple of months, and it's always worth it. So check that out, and we're going to take another little break here. Alrighty. Well, while I'm waiting for, I guess the caller here is running a little late, so I'm going to start reading from his book. I'm waiting for William Seward Bonney to call in the meantime. I think I'll read you some of his poems from the book. He must be running into some problems out there in Denver. So the name of the book is Galaxy versus Sabretooth, and this is by William Seward Bonney, and it's a Clefjaw book. It's the first release by Clefjaw, poetry. It's got a really great cover to it. It's a Sabretooth shooting rainbows out of its eyes, blowing up some geometric prisms in space, and I'll tell you what, it's worth it just for the cover. But the poetry inside is really, really great. He does it more justice than I will, because he's quite a great and he's a rapper, so most of this stuff is kind of like really wonderful beat raps, and I'll read some of it for you, and you can make up your own mind. This poem is called "Let the Universe Pour Abundant Provisions on You." 1. Art Deco architecture, fetch in a single word, more so, wretched, and at a foot, bourgeois, lewd. Smooth wrist bones broken at the disco. You know, she does too. This world will be all right without either of you. You'll be lucky not to be trampled on, danced over, lances lowered. For it's not in the way you pray. It's what you do day to day that makes you a saint, with eyes closed. I see in splattered paint, baptize myself in the rain. Understanding the meaning of life is courage and strength. 2. But I don't live anywhere. Here's not a liar. There's a patio with shrubs, overcast skies, and espresso. Humbums. who have a say no more. For oftentimes I am too loyal. Spoils of war is the knowledge bestowed. Oh, it's a landslide, though. This is an ode to the beautiful barista girl, the one with the button nose, curly hair, and no makeup, the one who's smiling at me and has no idea I'm writing to her. 3. I drive aimlessly around the front range, taking pulls off my cannabis pipe, accompanied by the sounds of Naked City. I feel rather alive. Inside is a heart which races, my brain is facial recognition software, and I'm tasteless, morally raped. I continue to stalemate with my emotions. Commotion signal devotion to substances and producing blues. Summer's lonely rules. But think, at one time I had so much love to lose. Funny how the world turns. 4. Giant steps to little places. All I asked for was a room with a view. Okay, here's another one. This one's called, This Head Is in a Tumble. I made a conscious effort to be awake in all the tunnels, car rides, bus rides, light rails, and planes. The days funneled out and trickled down the ladder. I was proud to fall down. Now, even more so, then the only ideas I have begin and end with the thoughts of your scent. Trends are but a fault. I'm split and at a loss, but the real time is tough. The only thing I ever wanted was trust. But I assumed it was luck, struck by the night's fare. It's fair to assume these black eyes deal with stares, brushes with death in the early morning subconscious, points to rumors, tumors which filter torment through these 2020s, guided words for worlds not finalized. I am but an italicized ink blot on a coffee stain. These teeth are bus rust. I rushed into thinking I'd die young. Now I feel as though I'm dead set on living longer, stronger, plastered, go-getter, counterculture, ratchet for hire. At any corporate chain, I use bleach in preparation for this resume. I pretend I want to buy video games, want to be a manager one day. It's all binary code out in the real world. Smile, polite, intellectual, but not opinionated. Easy to remember and hard to pick out in the room. The one with the non-regional accent and nonchalant demeanor. But these feelings are sincerely steadfast. My pledge is forever underground. Yeah, I'm a big fan of this guy. Looking for a specific poem in this book. The book, again, is Galaxy versus Sabretooth. And you should check it out. Okay, this one's called Our Last Days as Children. Wonder what will happen through these last days as children. Will it simply be a mind state of visitation? Or forever, given days of jubilation? Can I meditate through this planet of rhombus and prisms? Or is this all what I make of it? Quantum physics, tall statues and TV dinners, deliverance of flashing lights, sounds and colors, forever touched deep by the scent of fresh flowers, old railways and ghost towns. Radio towers would share my darkest memories and the memorabilia that reminds me of her singularity. Trails of depth in a chamber of trust forever commemorated and hung here on a wall from which time moves through and love is true too. Splashes of color paint a story of such, one of heartbreak, timing, victory, and lust. I hope you can trust with me as much as I trust in us, and we were born as titans, much greater than the gods. All right, I'm flipping through, looking for another particular one I wanted to read. Just give me a minute here. Once again, the poet is William Seward Bonney, and this one is called Athens County. We drank Everclear, sunset, and pineapple juice. Smoked Reds and viewed David Lynch shorts. We talked about future, our generation, and our favorite cannabis at the moment, Blue Dream. Smoked Camel Wides into the brusque Ohio nights, Athens. The bar habit occurs to me as we break into Budweiser in the morning. I've been writing all day, but nothing really of importance. Wendy's, other corporate name. These American days are the fucking same across the United States. I'm irate as I swing back and view Zach and Lou. They remind me why I love this life, why I live my time as for who. Austin's on my mind. Seattle? I may be in Denver by Sunday. I may be at the White House by morning, protesting my education and well-being up to this point. Living off Guadalupe in a co-op, standing on 16th with the end is near, scribbled on cardboard, so fucked in the head. I need another joint, Blue Dream. I don't. I want it to become legal because I know the consequences. I know the outcome. Brother, that's when I wake, when the movie's done. One of the few hours of my life when I can become lumber. I'm limber in the daylight, full of mumbles, exposing trouble. Rumbling with the tough and fucked up crowd of the winter. Eyes as wild as the Carlsbad Canyons. My senses are keen, as quiet as a coma. Loads of words I wish I'd yelled into the deaf ears of yesterday, ripe with the aroma of blood loss in the new millennium. Give me another key bump of whatever you got. Come. Later tonight in the whore you pretend is a lover. Bump. Fists with the guy you've been traveling with who wants to leave you at every stop. I think that's my favorite poem in this book. And I'm going to read another one, and this will take us out. This poem is called I Dealt With It. The Miles, the mindless sales pitch in the onset of carpal tunnel syndrome melting. It's best not to appear too forward. Scores of thoughts press on like riots, piloting. In other words, tripping the void. Moist morning mixers where childhood dreams scream like robotic eagles as we tore down the machine from the inside. Is it right? They were all good intentions once. Ghost ships glow along the horizon. Is it gone? We open our heads to the sounds of revelations, jubilation. Tribulations, spineless, tasteless, romantic symphonies, in other words, sensory orgy, glory as told by those who saw it, brushing it off from those who don't. My claws are in this vicious adaptation of cleanliness. I'm covered in a checkered past, laughing. I can barely remember past several concussions. These bridges wrap me up and beg me to stay here. It's been a long time since last year ended. Oh, fuck. So, yeah, I was hoping we get to talk to William Seward Bonney tonight, and I was hoping we get to talk to Lindsay Tom. But there's always next week, so this show is typically Tuesday nights, and I hope you'll check it out next Tuesday, and we'll leave it on that. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a good rest of your week.